Good day, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradoxes Sunday School class. Dr. Ross is here today. He's going to be speaking on the universe designed for 17 different purposes. So he'll be up here in a moment. He's not here next week, though. And we have a guest speaker, Peter DeMuth, who used to come to the class a lot, trying to get him back, but he's going to be presenting on the Exodus, and he has a surprise for us, some newer information. So try to be here, bring some friends, and we should have a good presentation. Dave Sargent has got books for everybody today. Come on up, Dave, and tell us about it. And then, of course, there are RTB books.
All right. Courtesy of Reasons to Believe and Hugh Ross, I have a new set of books, and we're pushing the reset button, and each class member can have one free book, courtesy of Reasons to Believe and Hugh Ross and myself. So I have a cart back here. You can come look at the carts. I have books, and I also have some DVD videos also. I'm going to highlight one, which is a really great book to get. This is out of print, and you can get these on eBay now, and they're selling for like two or three times what they were originally. So a very popular book, Hugh, and I would never would have guessed your books obviously have increased in value. And that's Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, about UFOs, residual UFOs, and a biblical perspective on UFOs. If you pick up a book, you need to sign and put your name there that you've gotten what your book, your one book. Thank you.
How are we doing on that, Dr. Ross? Is there a new edition coming out someday? Or okay, Dr. Ross says they are working on a new edition of Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, so stand by for that. This is a really great book. Easy to read, not too technical. And there's also a video that goes with it. I don't know, is that going to be remade also? Okay, great. Treats. Thank you, Valerie, Maria, and Doug, and anyone else that brought food for us. We have a lot of good treats today. And with that, let's say a prayer and we'll get Dr. Ross up here. Father, we thank you for blessing our Paradoxes class today. Please bless Dr. Ross and his messages for your miraculous universe. Give us understanding and witnessing tools as we go out into the world. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Dr. Ross, come on up.
Let me check. There we go. Thank you. All right. Yeah, good to see all of you here. And talking about Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. Yesterday, I was at a conference. I gave four messages at the conference. And one of them was on UFOs and extraterrestrials. And they all loved the slide I showed, which was what I thought the explanation for UFOs was when I was growing up. I was quite skeptical, wasn't yet a believer, and so I showed a little slide where you got working hours, and then you got sleeping hours, in between you got drinking hours, and you see a curve like this for UFO sightings, and then explain how no, that's not really the story. The story is that UFOs are most frequently seen when most people are asleep. 3 a.m. is the most common occurrence of UFO sightings. And typically, it's on lonely country roads. And said, well, guess who hangs out on lonely country roads at 3 a.m. in the morning? It's astronomers. That's where their telescopes are located, at the end of lonely country roads, and they're out there, and yet very few astronomers have encounters with UFOs. And that kind of led into what does explain it. One reason why we had to reprint, we did reprint Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, and yes, we are working on bringing out an update. It'll probably be a brand new book because there's so much more to write about, particularly in dispelling what's often the most common explanation for UFOs, that it's intelligent beings traveling on spaceships here to planet Earth from another planetary system. But we astronomers are actually wanting to send spacecraft to the nearest planet. It's only 4 light years away. And we recognize the biggest spaceship that can survive interstellar space is about 10 centimeters across. And even then, you got to send 1,000 of them, because we know over half of them will be totally destroyed. But the remaining, you might get a few dozen that are only partly destroyed. So the idea that beings like us are traveling across interstellar space, that simply isn't in the cards. But one reason for the popularity of our book, it's the only book I know on UFOs that actually offers a scientifically testable explanation for the UFO phenomenon. So that's why we're working on bringing out another book. But hey, the book I just finished is this one, Noah's Flood Revisited. And it's now being set up in pages, and I'm going to be working on the index in the next little while. And I've been sharing with a gentleman that just came up to me. I now got 3 more books that are on my plate that I need to write. So I'm actually doing the research for getting all 3 of them up and running. But there are a few chapters in Noah's Flood in this book, Navigating Genesis, and anyone can get a free chapter of the book by going to reasons.org/Ross. Well, last week we talked about how a theme about understanding Noah's Flood is we need to interpret in the context what the Bible tells us. The laws of physics don't change. And many interpretations of Noah's Flood invoke radically changed laws of physics during the few months of Noah's Flood. The Bible explicitly rules it out, and as I've been sharing with you, the spectra we take of stars and galaxies affirm of what the Bible declares indeed is correct. There's been no change in the laws of physics. Likewise, when we look at radioisotopes in the crust of the Earth and the decay products of those radioisotopes, they too declare there's never been any change in the laws of physics. But what we started last week is saying, okay, based on these laws of physics, what does it tell us about the universe and the reason why the universe exists? And we're addressing the atheist challenge, where atheists look at the universe and say, they look at our Earth too for that matter and say, you know, this can't be a God that's behind all of us, because we mortal human beings can actually think of a better way of designing the universe. However, the problem is they think there's only one purpose for the universe existing, that is to provide a home for life, a home for us human beings in particular. And yes, if that's the only reason for the universe, the only purpose of the universe, it is possible to conceive of a universe that would be different. For example, a universe where we humans wouldn't suffer at such a great degree of decay and tribulation and death. We could conceive of a universe which would have either a lot less of that or none of that. However, that would disturb the other purposes for the universe. And so, long before I became a Christian, I was looking at the different holy books of the religions of the world, and what struck me that was unique about Christianity is it offered a 2-creation model, and how God created this universe not just to provide a home for us human beings, but to be a means in his hands by which he could eradicate evil once and for all, at the same time greatly increase the capacity of human beings to express love and experience love. And, you know, this is the great mystery of the gospel. How is it that God can actually enhance our ability to experience and express love while at the same time eradicating evil? And the enigma of all that is that the more free will God gives us, the more opportunities there will be for people to express their free will against God. However, God could have easily resolved that by giving us a weak free will. But a weak free will means that we would only be able to express love and experience love at a weak level. God wanted strong love. Strong love meant strong free will. Strong free will meant there would be humans, there would be angels, that express that free will in rebellion against their creator. But God took that risk, but he actually designed the universe in such a way to be able to see the eradication of all sin and evil, and at the same time see the capacity of angels and us human beings who decide to go with God to experience and express more love. And so we kind of began to look at what are the purposes of the first creation, and then what are the purposes of the second creation. But this is unique to Christianity. You know, all religions talk about some kind of heaven, but the heaven they describe is a heaven that we can conceive of in the context of the physics and the dimensions of the universe. The heaven that the Bible describes is something that's impossible to conceive of within the context of the physics and the dimensions of the universe. It's a radically different creation. It's not just a slightly fixed up or restored universe. It's something radically different. In fact, what's unique about Christianity is that God creates the universe, and once evil is eradicated, he removes it from existence and replaces it with a brand new universe. So it's not a universe that's eternal, it's temporal. The second creation is eternal. Well, last week we began to look at what are the purposes of this first creation, and basically responding to the non-theist complaint, hey, I could make a better universe. Not if you want to fulfill all the purposes for which you created. Now, what I have in my book, Why the Universe is the Way It is 11 distinct purposes for the universe. That book came out in 2008. We've now added a few more. This morning I'm going to present you with 17 distinct purposes. And hey, I don't think that's a complete list. I think we'll discover more. And I think we may have to wait until the new creation when God says, you know what, I actually had 30 more purposes that you weren't aware of, but these are the 17 or 20 that I revealed to you. This is the fact that we can see these 17 distinct purposes and say, okay, what does it take to create a universe that can simultaneously fulfill all 17 purposes? I mean, you know, God could have made a 5 creation model or a 17 creation model, but he designed the universe in such a way that he can do it all with just 2 creations. Well, first of all, we do recognize that all human beings see that the universe is a place where humans can exist. And it's not just that we can exist, that we can thrive. And so we're not just sitting here on a planet barely eking out a living. We actually have an astounding standard of living, a capacity for leisure, capacity for enjoyment, a capacity to have relationships with one another. So it's not just a universe that allows us to survive at a subsistence level, but also to thrive. It's also designed in such a way that abundant, diverse life forms can live with us human beings. And we're here on planet Earth at the moment in the universe when our Earth can sustain the greatest abundance and diversity of plants and animals and microbes that can exist on this planet with us. In fact, what I've written in a couple of my books is when we look at the diversity of life on planet Earth and the abundance, we realize it's right at the theoretical limit of what the physics of the universe would permit. And so life begins on planet Earth about 3.8 billion years ago, but as we go forward from the 3.8 billion, we see that what God is doing is progressively packing the Earth with more and more species of life, with greater and greater abundance of life, and when it hits the theoretical maximum, he creates us human beings. And so he created us where we have this huge treasure chest of plant and animal and microbial life that we can enjoy and that we can use to sustain our well-being. And so we are blessed by all the other different life forms that are here on the planet with us. We're able to thrive because of the great diversity and abundance of plant life, of animal life, and microbial life that exists with it. And all that life not only blesses us physically, it blesses us emotionally, intellectually, and even spiritually. That's the message of the book of Job. Look to all these life forms that God created on the planet to cohabit with you. Examine them, enjoy them. They will teach you deep, important spiritual lessons. And that's kind of an exhortation for us who live in cities. Get out of the city once in a while and actually see the abundance of this life and recognize how they're designed to teach us these great spiritual lessons. And the thing we notice too is that we happen to be living in a universe that displays abundance of beauty, elegance, and symmetry. I mean, as an astronomer, I'm astounded at what we call these grand design galaxies, the elegance of these galaxies, and how our Milky Way galaxy is the most elegant of them all, the only one with symmetrical spiral arms. And we see this great beauty. I like posting images from telescopes on my Facebook and Twitter page, not only to teach people about the wonder of the universe, but to actually impress them with the beauty of what they're seeing. And you can't help but look at these images and be struck by the beauty. But that also pervades the entirety of God's creation. He purposely made plants and animals beautiful. I mean, I notice what I see, say, on my Apple computer. Every time Apple comes up with a new operating system, what do? They create a page that goes up on your computer that displays some aspect of beauty of the state of California. The latest one is operating system Sequoia. So what do? They grabbed a photo showing the majesty and the beauty and the symmetry of these Sequoia trees that exist here in California. But you can go back to the previous operating systems they brought out. What they're doing is basically showing, you know, what a beautiful state that this California is. And hey, it's not just California, all over the world, we see God's beauty being expressed. And we're the one species that God has created that actually can enjoy and appreciate beauty. The other plants and animals don't, we do. And the last thing we ended up with last week was he designed it to be a classroom to teach us. As it says in Romans chapter 1, the heavens, the creation, reveals there's a God behind all of it. It reveals the attributes of that God. The fact that we see beauty and elegance and symmetry throughout all of creation tells us something about the Creator. He too is a being who enjoys beauty and enjoys elegance and symmetry. We see that expressed throughout his creation. We see it expressed throughout us. As it says in Ecclesiastes, he's made everything beautiful in its own time. By the way, that applies to every one of you. We're all beautiful, and so as we engage one another, it's important as we relate to one another to seek out the beauty and the elegance that exists in every human being. We're all created beautiful in a different way from one another. 8 billion people are on planet Earth right now. Every one of those 8 billion people has a beauty. And I kind of like to do that when I'm relating to people, is saying, okay, God, show me what's beautiful and wonderful about this human you're bringing into my life at this moment. It is there, and the fun of being a human being is that we can search that out. Likewise, what I've seen in toddlers, for example, you put them loose in the backyard, what are they doing? They're looking for insects or looking for birds, and they'll handle them, and they see beauty in there. And so these little toddlers can teach us something, that they even pick up a rock and they can see beauty within the rock. But we're told in Romans chapter 1 that the creation reveals God. It reveals his personal attributes. And so let's jump into some more here. Notice that the creation is designed to show that they possess the image of God. I mean, there's a whole community of biochemists in the scholar community at Reasons to Believe. And I love just sitting in on their conversations when they get together around a table where they talk about the molecules they're discovering inside the cells of every life form and how they see in these cells these very elegant, symmetrical, and beautiful machines. And what's interesting is how eerily they're like just the machines that we build. So inside the cells, we can see rotary engines, we can see piston engines, we can see ratchet engines that are operating, and they're just like the engines that we've invented and use. The only difference is they're more beautiful and elegant than our machines. They're more efficient than our machines. So for example, there's a piston engine that operates in virtually every cell in the human body. It operates with about twice the efficiency of the most efficient piston engine in any vehicle that we human beings have ever built. Likewise, the rotary engine, it's three times more efficient than the rotary engines that we have built. But what we notice is God created us in such a way that we tend to invent and create in a manner that he tends to invent and create. Not at his level, but we see indeed we have been created where we emulate some of the characteristics of God. Now the distinction of that is what we see in Hebrews chapter 1. Every human being is created in the image of God, but only the creator of the universe, the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, is the exact representation of God. So the point is, though we're created in the image of God, we share with God certain attributes that he has, but only certain attributes. It's limited in that context. But we're the only species which you can say we actually share some of the attributes that God has. We don't see that in our pets. We don't see that in any other life form here on planet Earth. It is unique to us. But the creation is designed in such a way to show that we're special and distinct. And so, for example, as you look at all the animals that share the planet with, we recognize that the naturalists are wrong when they say that, after Charles Darwin, that, hey, there's just simply a progression in increasing complexity and sophistication as you go from the simplest animal life forms up to the more complex. Darwin would say there's a greater difference between a fish and a chimpanzee than there is a chimpanzee and a human being. What he was overlooking, of course, is that God has created three distinct kinds of life. Life that's purely physical, like fish, and then you have apes, like chimpanzees, that are not only physical, they're soulish, and that they can manifest emotions, mind, and will, and we human beings, the only species that is physical, soulish, and spiritual. And how God created the birds and the mammals. Fish, they'll respond to you when you come home. I mean, I used to have a fish tank, and the fish there would get all excited when I walked through the door. It wasn't that they were excited about having an emotional relationship with me. They knew that they were going to get fed soon. And so they'd start swimming around in anticipation that they would be fed. However, I've had a number of birds and dogs and cats as pets. They respond very differently. They're actually more excited to greet me emotionally than to figure, okay, here's the guy that's going to take me on a walk, or here's a guy that's going to give me food. No, any of you have had a pet like that, a bird or a mammal, realize they have a strong motivation to emotionally please you and to serve you and to relate to you and to kind of discern what you want and fulfill those needs. And so they were created to serve and please us, but that actually teaches us a lesson. As they were created to serve and please to relate to a higher species, we humans were created to serve and please and relate to a higher being. And so again, God created these life forms to teach us lessons. Just like when we tame these animals, they outperform their wild cousins, and we get tamed by our creator, we outperform people who don't have a relationship with their creator. If you want to read more about that, it's in the book I've written, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, the multiple spiritual lessons these animals teach us. And just like our sin causes these animals to run away from us instead of towards us, likewise our sin causes us to run away from God, or we see in Romans 1, to pretend that he doesn't exist. The heavens, the creation, is revealed in such a way that it clearly, that's what it says in Romans 1, It clearly, unmistakably reveals that there's a God that produced everything and created us. And not only clearly reveals that this God exists, but even in detail his personal attributes. But as you read on in Romans chapter 1, what does it say? It says, we human beings engage in self-imposed ignorance. And so you got people saying, well, Christianity can't be true, because what about those who have never heard? Well, Romans 1, Psalm 19 is telling us everybody has heard. Everybody knows there's a God. Everybody knows what kind of God it is, that it's not the God of Islam or the God of Hinduism or Buddhism. It's the God of Christianity. We all know that, but we engage in self-imposed ignorance. And the greater we become overcome with sin, the greater we engage in self-imposed ignorance. It's important to recognize that when you're trying to share your faith, say, with a committed atheist. Just realize they've been practicing self-imposed ignorance for a long time, and therefore it's going to be more challenging. But one thing I learned when I was at Caltech trying to engage these people, I get farther with them when I take them out into nature. Get them out into the high Sierras where they get to see the wildlife, they get to see the beauty, and that makes it so much easier to begin to engage in a spiritual conversation. In fact, I can remember two atheists, scientists at Caltech, in the hallways of Robinson Laboratory at Caltech. The moment I brought up something spiritual, they would walk away. Get them out around a campfire over a meal after a hike in a beautiful place in the high Sierras, and we can have a four-hour conversation about Christianity and matters of the spirit. And so God indeed designed creation to open up those possibilities. And also to show our need for redemption. In terms of the laws of physics, in fact, that was one of the talks I gave yesterday at this conference, how, you know, we live in this world where we're subjected to gravity. And, you know, gravity over time causes different body parts to sag. We're exposed to electromagnetic radiation. And what does it do? It causes our sun, our skin to wrinkle and decay. And then you have to go here in California, because of all the solar exposure we got, you got to go to the dermatologist and get your skin cancer zapped. I mean, you know, couldn't God have created a universe where we don't have such intense radiation impinging and destroying our skin? And then, you know, what about this thermodynamics that just causes everything to decay? And you can go into the strong and weak nuclear force. But the whole point is, those laws of physics are crucial tools in God's hands for the eradication of sin and evil. And you see this right away in Genesis chapter 3, third chapter of the Bible, where God says to Adam and Eve, after they've rebelled against him, from now on, you're going to have to experience more work. From now on, you will be experiencing more pain. Ecclesiastes adds, from now on, you're going to have to spend more time. And what he's referring to is, because of your sin, you're going to have to spend more time, you're going to experience more pain, you're going to have to do more work to undo the damage that your sin has caused to your environment and the people around you and to yourself. And, you know, the laws of physics are designed in such a way, and biologically we human beings are designed in such a way, none of us likes extra work. None of us likes extra pain. And we don't like having to spend more time. I mean, time is valuable. And so the laws of physics are structured in such a way basically to motivate us to avoid evil, to avoid sin, and pursue virtue. If we go on a virtuous path, we experience a lot less pain, a lot less work, and we wind up having more time to ourselves. And so life is good if we pursue virtue. If we pursue sin and rebellion and evil, the consequences mean that life no longer is pleasant. You know, and those of us who are parents, we try to discipline our children in such a way that they will experience more work, more pain, and more wasted time in proportion to the sin they commit. But one of the things I've learned as a parent is just how clever my two sons were at trying to transfer the extra pain, the extra work and time to their mother and me, rather than they themselves having to experience it. And so the real challenge of being a parent is to ensure, hey, that your child. And so it's so much faster for me to clean up the room than for them to clean up the room. And I got to waste a lot of time basically supervising to make sure they actually do it. And I realized, hey, it'd be faster if I didn't have to supervise and just do it for them. But realizing that would not be right. It's very important to invest the time. And so as a parent, I experience more pain and more work and wasted time trying to supervise my children in such a way to ensure they experience the pain, the work, and the wasted time from the sin that they committed. And so this extends to authority as well. And of course, that's true of our whole justice system. Our whole justice system is set up in such a way that those that commit crimes are the ones that experience more pain, more work, and more wasted time. And, you know, I've talked to people who've been to prison, and they refer to it as doing time. But as I talk to them, I say, well, what was it like in terms of the work and the pain? And this is where I realize our justice system needs to be reformed in such a way as to ensure that all three are there, but not so much pain that they're not able to do the work, or so much work that they experience so much pain it causes them health. There's a way to balance it. But that again means that the people in charge of the justice system need to be willing to experience more pain, more work, and wasted time to ensure those that commit the crime get exactly the optimal measure of a pain, work, and wasted time. But the real lesson in these laws of physics is that it teaches us, yes, it's certainly to my benefit to pursue a virtuous life and not commit any sin, because look at all the time I'm going to save, and I'm not going to have all this work and all this pain. It's an obvious thing to do, but as we pursue that path, and this is best exemplified in the book of Job, where Job says, I tried that, and it doesn't work. I don't have what it takes to live a completely virtuous life. And you see this in chapter 7 of Romans, where Paul makes the point, I know this truth, but as hard as I try, I can't do what I know is best for me. I fail. And all of us fail. And this is a lesson in the way that God created the universe. Basically, it's teaching us, hey, there's a God out there that's incredibly powerful. Look at all that he created. You know, 2 trillion galaxies, where every galaxy is 100 billion stars plus. I mean, the immensity of what he created, the diversity of what he created, the elegance and beauty of it all, that takes a God who's incredibly powerful to pull it off. A God that's that powerful surely is powerful enough to do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And as you examine the creation, you realize the one that created this has to be orders and orders of magnitude, more knowledgeable and more intelligent than we human beings. A God that intelligent and that knowledgeable must know a way to do for us that we can't do for ourselves. But then we look at the beauty and the elegance and the care that's expressed in what God created, and it tells us this God must be orders and orders of magnitude more loving than we human beings. And so it addresses the question, is God loving enough to do for us what we can't do for ourselves? And it was Job who said yes to all three. God is powerful enough, he's knowledgeable, intelligent enough, and he's loving and caring enough to do for me what I can't do for myself. So long before there was any scripture, what did Job say in the 19th chapter? I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him on the last day. I will see him with my own eyes. Oh, how my heart yearns for that day when that will happen. He also knew that the Redeemer had to be the Creator himself. He figured out all that theology just by looking at the universe. Now, he had advantages we don't have today. When he looked up at the sky, he could see 15,000 stars. Here in the Los Angeles Basin, on a really clear night, we look up the sky, maybe we can see 30 stars. That doesn't have quite the impact that it does when you see 15,000 stars, when you see the Milky Way and all the nebula across the sky, when you see the movements of the planets. He was probably able to see the planet Uranus with a naked eye. It can be done if you know exactly where it is and you're in a very dark site, but given the fact that he was not having to deal with light pollution or air pollution, there's a good chance he was even able to see the movement of the planet Uranus across the sky. So, however, we got advantages too. He didn't have the Hubble Space Telescope. He didn't have the James Webb Space Telescope. He didn't have microscopes where we could see the beauty and the elegance of these microbial creatures. And so we've got advantages he didn't have. So we can't say, well, it was easy for Job, but it's really hard for us. No, it's just as easy for us as it was for Job. What he had, though, was humility, wisdom, and grace that enabled him to see what his three friends, for example, were not able to see. So God said, I want you to pray for my friends, that their eyes would be opened. And another point is, notice he created the universe in such a way that not only can we humans exist, we can exist on a planet where we can develop a large population and high technology civilization. Now, you could actually predict that long before we developed the technology. Okay, it tells us in Revelation 7 that the number of people that God is going to redeem from sin and evil will be an uncountable number. At the time that was written, the Greeks had a numbering system that went up to 1 billion, basically saying the host of redeemed human beings will be in the billions. Okay, what is it going to take for billions of human beings, for those that already follow God, basically get the gospel message out to people all over the world? And so even if you were living, say, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, you could predict that technology was going to come. You'd also notice that humans have always been advancing technology. So from, in fact, the book I've just written on the flood is making the point. What we consider to be unique to the historic era when people had a written language actually goes way, way, way back. Humans, for example, were engaged in sophisticated agriculture at least 40,000 years ago, where they were planting grains, harvesting grains. We now know that the earliest humans had a tooth and a jaw anatomy such that they were not able to eat the coarse raw food that other animals were eating. And so we know, for example, Adam and Eve must have had the ability to be able to process and cook food for the simple reason we don't have the anatomy to only eat raw foods. We have a very high caloric demand. So, for example, we need more calories than the great apes that share the planet with us, way more. How we got those calories, we were able to process and cook food in such a way that we could get enough calories and enough nutrients. And because of the way our jaw and teeth is structured, it tells us even the earliest humans must have had that capacity. And we can actually document that, that it goes back at least 40,000 years, which means it's likely to go back even earlier than that. We also now know, what you see in Genesis chapter 4, it talks about early humans before the flood having the capacity for metallurgy. And people have shook their heads and saying, that can't be. We don't have any evidence for humans using metals until about 4,000 years ago, maybe 5,000 years ago, but not earlier than that. Well, there were fewer humans around back then. And the farther back in time you go, the more challenging it is to come up with archaeological finds. But they have found archaeological finds showing that people in the far north were engaged. Excuse me. Basically, archaeologists were trying to find evidence for metallurgy say, in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and they had failed to really look for it in the far north. And the advantage of the far north is it snows, and the snow stays all winter. In fact, I remember growing up in Canada, they say there's a good reason why the best hockey players come from Saskatchewan. They have natural ice for 10 months of the year. So, they have just two seasons. They got winter and a season of poor sledding. So, but the whole point is, when you're in a place where there's just snow and ice everywhere, it's really easy to find stainless steel meteorites. There's actually about 25% of meteors that fall to the earth where there's actually something to be found. 25% of them are a grade of stainless steel that's better than what you get from most steel mills. But it also has a black crust over it. And so you have this black rock sitting on the snow. It sticks out like a sore thumb. And people living in the far north in the wintertime, they would basically walk around and they would look for these black rocks, knowing that it would be virtually a pure grade. That's basically iron, nickel, and cobalt. And the cobalt and nickel means it won't rust. And so we now know that 12,000 years ago, probably far earlier than that, people in the far north would gather these stainless steel meteorites and cold forge them into sophisticated tools. It explains, for example, during the last ice age, there was a huge region north of Siberia because the sea levels fell and exposed all this land and basically almost doubled the size of Siberia. And what's interesting is that we now know that humans were not living in what is Siberia today. They were living north of Siberia because it was basically a very low plain and was actually warmer than what you see in what is today Siberia. So that's where the northern people lived, but it's a place where the snow would be there and it would gather up these stainless steel asteroids. And to be able to live in that area, they needed to have sophisticated tools. And so that's the one place that had it. And probably that goes back much, much earlier. And so the idea that Genesis 4 can't possibly be true, we now know through the latest finds that indeed could indeed be true. So it was all created to make possible a high-tech civilization, and nothing less than a high-tech civilization would enable humanity to take the good news of salvation to all the people groups of the world. I mean, hey, Nancy, what you do as a ministry, you're involved in distributing these little video recordings of the gospel to people all over the world in over 200 different languages. 2,000 different languages? Okay. Okay, yeah, she's brought copies of the class before. So how many languages now? You said over 2,000?
Over 2,000. But there are, over 7,000 languages in the world, so we still have a ways to go.
Yeah, 7,000 languages in the world, but I've also been told because of high-tech civilization, very soon over 4,000 of those languages will disappear. Yeah, because, you know, where you got high-tech civilization, small language groups have to engage people in big language groups. So what do? They drop their language and adopt the major language. And so literally every week a language disappears from the human species. So I think that's going to make your job a little easier, right? But you should still be working on it. But I mean, yeah. Then same thing with Bible translation. You know, all the big population languages have been translated. So the Bible's available in all those languages. And there's a fellow who is part of this class who's involved in South Sudan and Bible translation. And I get his newsletter, and what he shares with me is they're now translating the Bible where you've got language speakers of, say, as small as 10,000 individuals. Only 10,000 people speak that language. But they're producing Bibles for those 10,000. But typically, if it's less than 1,000, it's a language that quickly disappears because people have to engage one another. So in one sense, we're seeing the reverse of what happened in Genesis chapter 11. And so in my own lifetime, I've seen that. When I was a graduate student, there were 11 different languages in which astrophysical paper, research papers were published. And so to get my PhD, I had to be fluent in French. I also had to have a reading ability in German. And hey, there were people in our department who got a reading ability also in Spanish and in Russian and Chinese. What I've noticed today at universities where they're teaching astronomy and physics, they've abandoned the language requirement. Why? Because 100% of all the research papers are published in English. And there's a reason for that. English is the largest vocabulary language. And the thing about science, I keep trying to share this with the editors at Reasons to Believe, because they keep editing my articles and saying, hey, this is a word that's kind of obscure and only known to scientists. Let's use a word that's more accessible to a lay public. And I say, yeah, it's more accessible, but it's not quite right. You know, scientists want to make very fine nuances of what they're writing about in their literature. And so you might think that these are all synonyms that mean the same thing. From a scientific perspective, they all mean something slightly different. Well, notice English is the only language where we have this enormous abundance of synonyms, where the synonyms are not all identical. They all mean slightly something slightly different. I'll give you an example. How many synonyms do we have the word for thin? We got over a dozen words that mean thin, but they all connote something slightly different. So for example, here's several synonyms for thin. Slender, svelte, slim. Now those kind of communicate some positive aspects of being thin, right? But then there's some negative ones. Scrawny, emaciated. So they communicate, you know, they're all saying that the person is thin, but they all communicate a slightly different nuance than what is meant by the thin individual. And so referring to a woman as scrawny means something quite different than referring to her as svelte. I mean, most women would be quite pleased to be referred to as being svelte, but not so pleased by being referred to as scrawny or emaciated. So again, but that applies, which is one reason why English is kind of dominating in those parts of communication where an extremely large, diverse vocabulary is necessary. Okay, I got off on a wrong track there. So, but the creation is also designed, and wait a minute, I'm way over time. I'm so sorry, I was hoping to get through all this, but I got diverted. And that often happens to me, but a lot of you tell me you really love the tangents and the diversions I go off on. But hey, you always have permission to say, Hugh, you're going off on a tangent. Please bring us back to the topic. I give you permission to do that. But I'm going to stop right here, and I will take questions. And as always, we'll alternate between those of you that are here in person and those that are participating online. So do we have an online question?
Online questions. For those of you in our audience, you can go to paradoxes.org and write in a question if you don't want to come up to the mic. Otherwise, come on back here. We'll take turns alternating. Or if you want to just write it on a piece of paper, I'll read it to Dr. Ross. First question from Justin. We're okay. Sound's coming through, all right? Okay. Young earthers say the earth must be young because of the quality or the geniality in the Bible. What is your response to that? Also, could the earth be old and human species only 6,000 to 10,000 years old?
Okay, two good questions in terms of the young earth creationist perspective on the Bible and the creation. What about the genealogies? I presume they're referring to the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11. And I think it's important first to point out There's not a single genealogy in the Bible that's exhaustively complete. They all drop the names of certain generations. And so the key is to read those genealogies and determine why are some names included, some individuals included, and why are some names dropped. And so, for example, as you go through the historical Old Testament books, notice how frequently the name Dan is dropped. Now, Jacob had 12 sons, and yet in some of the genealogies it only mentions 11 of his sons. Or if they want to have 12, what do? They mention the two sons of Joseph. So the two sons of Joseph get in, Joseph gets dropped, and Daniel gets dropped. They still have 12 names. But when you read the book of Judges, you get an idea why Dan was dropped. The tribe of Dan fell into some extreme moral impurity that you see described, especially in the book of Judges. And so God is saying, okay, we're going to drop Dan to make a spiritual point. Other points that notice, hey, instead of mentioning the men, it brings women into the line. And it's making the point that the gospel is both for men and women. And notice how many genealogies talk about the harlot that was, Rahab the harlot that was in Jericho, basically saying you can be part of a line that was condemned for extermination, but God can select you out. Even if you've been involved in horrific sins, God can forgive. And so it's making the point the gospel is for sinners, even people who've committed gross sins in their life. And recognize that in the Old Testament, the word for father, Ab, also means grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather. And the word for son, likewise, Ben, can mean grandson, great-grandson. So it's not like English, where we use the word son only to refer to the direct offspring of a particular man and woman. Or likewise, we only use the word father to refer to the one that gave birth to us. So the words father and son have different meanings. And there's been many articles. There's an article written on the reasons.org website that goes into the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies in exquisite detail, looks at all the Hebrew words, looks at the grammar that's used in Genesis 5 and 11, but basically argues that you could have considerable passage of time between Adam and Noah, and Noah and Abraham. And so that's not an argument for a young earth. Now, it is an argument, however, against the idea that Adam lived, say, 2 to 4 million years ago. The genealogies are not that incomplete, but nor can you argue that you can just add up all the numbers and get a date for Adam or get a date for Noah. And the proof of that is young earth creationists who basically think that there's no gaps in the genealogies, when they try to get a date for Noah's flood by starting with Abraham and working back through the genealogies, they get a different date than if they go from Adam and go forward. How big is the difference? It's a little more than a hundred year difference. So that fact alone should tell them there has to be gaps in the genealogies, because if there were no gaps, you should get the same number going forward from Adam as you do backward from Abraham, but you don't. The second question, I'm trying to remember what the second question was. Could humans be relatively recent and the universe be old? Well, it certainly fits a biblical perspective, because the Bible tells us that the last creation event that God performed was the creation of Eve. When he created Eve, he stopped creating. And so that would tell us that Adam and Eve would be the most recent of God's creation events. And so, yes, you could have Adam and Eve a whole lot more recent than, say, the dinosaurs or the first animals on the face of the earth or the first vegetation in the continents or before the continents or before God created the earth. So you could definitely have, say, the earth billions of years old and humanity only thousands of years old. Could you have humanity only 6,000 years old? I don't think that's tenable. And this is something I document in the book coming out on the flood, is that today we've got carbon 14 dates, for example, of when humans developed sophisticated agriculture. We got carbon 14 dates of the remains of humans that goes back 45,000 years. And then we got the artifacts associated with humans that we can also carbon 14 date. And you say, well, carbon 14 isn't reliable. Yes, the cosmic ray conversion of carbon or nitrogen into carbon 14 does vary because it depends on the radiation environment that the different samples are exposed to. However, we can calibrate it with tree rings, with barbs, with corals, and ice and sediment cores. And so one thing I'm putting in the book is actually a calibration curve, basically showing you how indeed there's a slight variation, but the variation is below the 10% level. And so you're not gonna get dates that extend beyond 10% of what you measure with carbon 14. But I do agree that you can't push humanity back a million years ago. We're talking thousands, maybe a few tens of thousands of years, but it can't be as recent as 6,000 or 10,000. It's older than that. And in fact, if you look at the biblical text, it's clear that the Garden of Eden can only exist during an ice age. And likewise, the event of Noah's flood can only be possible during an ice age. So it tells us we have to push humanity back at least into the last ice age. Okay, next question.
There's two funny ways of looking about the creation of women. It's like maybe, and this is tongue in cheek, when God created woman last, he said, oh, that's enough of this creation stuff, when he saw woman. Or he might have said, wow, that's the best thing I've made. And then he said, that's enough. Okay, just a joke, I'm sorry. Okay. But my question is about free will in heaven. Of course, we've seen verses where it says there's that God's going to wipe away every tear, and then when people do things for the wrong motives, they'll they'll suffer loss, but their soul will be saved. So there is suffering, it seems like, in heaven, but personally, I kind of think like it happens right away but at the mercy seat of Christ, and then after that, there's no more suffering. But I've always thought, you kind of taught, like, in order for us to have free will, we have to have the capacity to do evil. So if we have free will in heaven, is it just that we're going to have choices of good things we can do, and that's the extent of it, or do we know? That's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. What about free will in heaven? If there's going to be no evil, how does that work out? Well, we notice about the new creation, the only people that get access to the new creation, same thing's true of the angels, are those who've decided that they're going to submit to God for the rest of eternity. They've already made a decision. Moreover, they've already been tested by the most challenging tests in the context of evil. And so one of the things we talked about last week, remember we started off with a question, why did God let Satan into the Garden of Eden? It's so that we humans get exposed to the most challenging tests in the context of evil. He's the most powerful, most intelligent creation that God ever performed. There is no creature more powerful and more intelligent than Satan. He's the first that decided to rebel against God. And so when you get tested by Satan, you're being tested by the most potent test possible in all of creation. If you pass that test, it means that you are secure in your relationship with Jesus Christ. You've already passed the most challenging tests. Nothing else is going to dissuade you. So it's basically making a point. The only people, the only angels that will be in the new creation are those who have already been exposed to the most challenging tests and have passed that test. And we pass that test because we go to God for help to pass that test. And so The analogy I gave in why the universe is the way it is what happens when you actually enter into a PhD program. And so, you know, part of my PhD experience was there was a day when the professors in the astronomy department threw at me the hardest questions they could think of in the context of astronomy and physics. We call that the general exams, which means you're not only going to be tested on your particular specialty in astrophysics, you're going to be tested about the broad whole field of astrophysics. And those professors can ask you any question they want, and the whole idea is they want to make sure you're able to have the background, the knowledge, the understanding of that whole area. And the same thing happens when you do your thesis defense, is that, you know, you get a team of professors. On my thesis defense, there were 10 professors that basically grilled me for a six-hour period. And so that's not typical on a thesis exam. In my case, it happened because one of the professors was disputing the claims of my observational measurements. And so it went on a little longer than necessary. So the only reason why it only went on for 6 hours, they were getting hungry. So, and they asked me, should we have a lunch break? And I said, no, I don't want a lunch break. Because I knew there was a limit to how long these professors could go without eating. So, but the whole point is, I got subjected to these rigorous tests, and then they had me take the hardest courses that they could devise in astrophysics. You pass those too. And so when they award you a PhD, it basically guarantees that never again will you have to be tested for your competency in that particular discipline. So you get a PhD in physical chemistry, a PhD in biochemistry. It basically guarantees we put you through such rigorous testing, it's not possible to give you an even more rigorous test. You've passed them all. Therefore, it's senseless to test you again. The same principle applies. God exposes us to the most challenging tests. He helps us pass that test. By the way, that's something that our professors at the University of Toronto did. I remember the first day I came in to the university, they sat down, all of us freshmen, graduate astronomy students, and said, this is the finest university in Canada. We're going to put you through some really rigorous testing, and you're not going to make it without our help. But we have an open-door policy. If you need help, you can come into our office, and we'll give you priority. But they also told us, if you don't seek our help, you're not going to make it. We're going to put you through such rigorous testing, it will not be possible. Now, of the 13 of us, 7 of us got the PhD. 6 did not. And I know 2 of those 6 did not take adequate response to the offer the professors made. Now, here's the difference. The professors told us, we're here to help you do what you can't do by yourself, but they didn't guarantee we were going to pass if we did seek their help. I knew one of the students who did get a lot of help from those professors. He still didn't get the PhD. The difference with Christianity, God says, if you come to me for what you can't do for yourself, I guarantee you'll pass this most challenging test. He gives us a guarantee. And that guarantee implies we enter the new creation. Yes, our free will will be stronger, but we're never going to exercise it in rebellion against our Creator. Excellent question. It's something I wish everyone would think about, Christian and non-Christian alike. Okay.
Someone asked that if you could show the previous slide, I think it was last week, had the first 6 purposes. Oh, that one, okay. The one with the galaxies.
Our phone's out and take a photo of it. Okay. Nobody takes notes anymore, I notice when I speak. They just get their phone out and...
Okay, we have a question here from Valerie. Regarding the newly released quantum AI computer chip, Michio Kaku and other scientists worry about its power. Why the fear, and does it support multiverse theory? Why the fear, and does it support multiverse?
Okay. From what I understand, they're talking about these new chips that are going to enable a step function increase in AI capability, AI referring to artificial intelligence. And yes, there's a lot of concern. What is this sophisticated AI going to do? So for example, I'm working on preparing a couple of papers to be published in scientific journals, and they have a requirement. I have to put at the end to what degree I used AI to prepare the paper. And if you use it to fulfill the whole thing, you're not going to get accepted. And you got the highest probability to say, I don't use AI. So, but AI can help. And I've noticed, for example, I can give these AI systems, say a paper I've written to communicate to research scientists and tell them, hey, rewrite this thing to communicate to people at an 8th grade level. And it'll spit it out. But what I've noticed is this, if I give it the whole paper, it gets a whole lot of it wrong. Because what AI is now doing is surveying everything on the web. It doesn't necessarily know what's reliable on the web and what's not reliable on the web. How many of you have ever used ChatGPT? Okay, a few of you have. Notice that ChatGPT basically asks you questions. How well did I do? That's because it's trying to figure out where did I go wrong? And if you tell it where it goes wrong and it gets confirmed by other people, it actually gets added to the software so the next time it doesn't make that mistake. So AI is actually teaching itself how to get better and better and better. Now, this new AI technology, right now technology is at a level where they say, we're not going to let it access the academic literature. It only accesses what's on the web. But of course, a lot of what's on the web comes from the academic literature. A lot of it sneaks in. So you can get some good material that way. But one thing I've learned, and this is something that was published in Japan, the best way to use AI is to get the best human expert in that area to work with the AI system. And you want the AI system, you want the human expert to launch the thing and tell the AI, look here, but don't look here, here, and here. You basically restrict it. Let the AI do its job, and then the human expert comes in and says, oh, wait a minute, let's fix this, this, and this. You let the AI run again, so it's a cooperation. But they discovered if you put in a junior expert and you have it work with the AI, you get much inferior results than if you have the top expert work with the AI system. You get better results if you have several top experts work on the system. And again, you need to understand what is the AI system designed to really do. So for example, ChatGPT is not good at math. Minerva is better at math than ChatGPT. But keep this in mind, neither of these AI systems are able to reason. They can simply take what's already out there, the databases that are out there, and they can manage it. And so, for example, I can give ChatGPT, and there's another system I use as well, where I take a technical article and I say, turn it into a comic book that can be read by someone at a 7th grade level. It will do it, it'll do all the artwork, and it's all done in 15 seconds. It's just incredible. And so we're actually thinking, maybe we should bring out a comic book series from the material we developed at Reasons to Believe. So, but there are concerns, and notice the scientific journals are now requiring us to specify where we use AI. So if you say, yeah, I did use AI, they say, well, tell us, where did you use it? And so the reader knows this. And there's actually a bill before Congress that when you go to an online therapist, if the therapist is an AI system, they have to tell you, I'm not a real human being. I'm an AI system. And I'm sure a lot of you have been on the online where you get this little pop-up box, prove that you're not a robot. Have you ever seen that? I mean, I get that almost every day. Because they're AI systems, it'll basically fool what's out there in the internet and say, hey, you know, give me this. And so if you want to make sure you're dealing with a human being, you get a little pop-up box that makes you prove that you're not a robot. The problem is AI systems are getting good enough where they can pass prove that I'm not a robot tests. And so they're now needing to come up with systems that make the tests a little more difficult. The problem is the tests are now becoming sufficiently difficult that humans have a hard time passing the tests. So these are some of the challenges we're facing with AI. So, but rest assured, we're not all going to be unemployed because AI is going to do all the work for us. AI cannot reason. And, you know, AI can fake empathy and fake love, but it is really a fake. And but it's very good at Rogerian therapy, asking questions where it doesn't have to actually give you any advice, just ask you questions. So it can look like, and you can program AI to say very empathetic things to the human operator. You say, hey, this is way better than talking to my children or talking to my spouse. This thing really seems to care for me. No, it's all just been programmed. So those are some of the risks we're facing. And yes, who knows where this is going to go 10 years from now. So, but keep in mind, you're already being manipulated by AI. Every retailer, online or brick and mortar retailer, uses AI to encourage you to buy stuff you really don't need to buy. So, if you ever walked into a store, notice what they put right by the front door. Notice what they put at the back. Notice how they group things together. It was an AI system that told them how to place products in the store to get you to buy more stuff than you otherwise would buy. And by the way, it works. AI is causing us to buy 20% more than we would buy without AI. So if you're wondering why your checkbook doesn't look as healthy as it does, you can blame AI.
Okay. All right. Here's a suggestion from JG. I think you pretty much covered it with your purposes earlier, but Hugh, you've always said that the universe is created by God as well as the earth to eradicate evil. Could you expand on that or have a Sunday school class on that?
Yes, I could do that. I mean, it is in Why the Universe is the Way It Is. What motivated me to write Why the Universe is the Way It is I kept running into these unbelieving scientists who were not satisfied with Christian answers to the problem of evil. And so, is there a scientific way to respond to the problem of evil? And that was really my motivation, saying, yes, the laws, we actually can give a scientific answer to why there's evil in the world. And it's thanks to the laws of physics, the way the universe is designed, that we can look forward to the eradication of evil. So, but yeah, that might be worth, I did a series on this about 15 years ago. It might be worth repeating that.
Sure.
I don't think we archive that far back at paradoxes.org, do we? I'm wondering if it's there.
We did. We can check it and see.
Because maybe what we can do is pull that back up and put it where in a little package where people can access it. If not, we can redo it.
Someone named Grand Junction, Hugh, what use is a tree of life in a supposed young earth scenario? Adam couldn't die, so didn't need it before the fall, and Adam immediately lost access to it after the fall. So what use would there be for it?
You know, there's a wide spectrum of beliefs about the tree of life amongst both old earth creationists and young earth creationists. So it's not just that there's a young earth interpretation and an old earth interpretation. There's actually a spectrum of interpretations. So there are people, for example, who believe that Adam and Eve, when they were in the Garden of Eden before they sinned, would have lived forever whether or not they ate of the tree of life. Then others say, well, no, wait a minute. They would have been headed towards death, but if they ate of the tree of life, it would reverse the decay in their body and they'd be able to continue living. And so they look at the tree of life as being kind of like the fountain of youth, is that, hey, if you're seeing that your body's beginning to decay, you can go to the tree of life, eat of its fruit, it'll reverse the decay. And then there's also debate, well, if you eat of the tree of life, does that take care of the decay once and for all and you live forever after the first bite? Or do you have to go back again and again and again to eat of the tree of life? And then we notice there's a tree of life in the new creation. And it says, hey, if we already have perfected bodies and the laws of physics aren't operating there, why is the tree of life there? What purpose does it have? Well, we don't know what God's going to create in the new creation. We won't need the tree of life, but maybe there will be other creatures that will need the tree of life. Or maybe it's there to kind of remind us of the lesson that he was trying to teach us all along about the tree of life. We don't know what the purpose of the tree of life is precisely in the new creation. I'm just simply making the point. There's a lot of speculation and debate on both the part of young earth creationists and old earth creationists about the tree of life. Where we differ, however, is that young earth creationists believe that when Adam and Eve fell, the laws of physics changed, at least to some degree. Whereas old earth creationists say there's been no change in the laws of physics, and that's what I've been teaching here. You can go to the Bible itself, and the Bible makes it clear there's been no change in the laws of physics. But young earth creationists, they need it for the flood, and also they claim it happened at the fall of Adam. So on two different occasions, you got changes in the laws of physics. But hey, the creation itself tells us there's been no change in the laws of physics. The Bible tells us there's been no change in the laws of physics. People that are new, either online or here, I think if you go back, three or four or five Sundays, you'll see a recording at paradoxes.org where we go through how the Bible shows there's been no change in the laws of physics and how creation shows there's been no change in the laws of physics. Hopefully that takes care of it.
All right, well, we are out of time and just want to thank you for all your participation. Can you close us in prayer, please?
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time that you've given us. We thank you for every day you give us to live here on planet Earth. We thank you for the beauty of the creation that you made that we can enjoy. We thank you for the beauty that you put in every human being, in every creature. Help us, Lord, to seek that beauty out when we engage one another, to appreciate one another as you appreciate each one of us. Thank you for your great love bestowed upon us. Thank you for the very high value you put on every human being. Help us to reflect that image that you've put upon us, the image of God, that we too can seek the beauty within us and seek the beauty that's within everyone that we get to meet, whether it be a human, whether it be an animal, whether it be a plant. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.